In the book, I mentioned this line that I've always loved of Marvin Hagler's when he says something like, if when I die you cut open my brain, you're going to find in it a boxing glove because that's all I am, a boxer. But in the same way, in a Hagler-like way, I feel even at this advanced age, I still feel I'm that sort of grammar school boy because it was the crucible in which I became the person that I am.
It's Shelf Life. On this episode, genre-defying writer Jeff Dyer on a subject very close to his heart, himself. In his new memoir, Homework, he conjures his childhood in 1960s England under the long shadow of the Second World War. We'll also discuss how that wartime legacy inspired Jeff's book choice for this episode, Brave Men by Ernie Pyle, a landmark collection of World War II dispatches that Dyer describes as news that stays news. Stay with us.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Jordan's military says it's shot down three ballistic missiles coming from Iran. This is the latest attack on Jordan in recent days. U.S. Central Command says two U.S. service members were killed and a third is missing after Iranian attacks there Friday. NPR's Carrie Khan reports.
Sirens blared throughout the Jordanian capital, Amman, late Sunday afternoon, alerting the incoming missiles from Iran. Three were intercepted and a fourth fell in a remote area, according to Jordan's military. There were no reports of casualties or damage. Earlier, the U.S. Embassy in Amman had warned of a potential attack by Iran on the airport and seaport in Aqaba, in southern Jordan. A Jordanian official denied an attack was imminent. Israel's military also issued a warning for its southern city of Eilat across the border from Aqaba. Iran has intensified its attacks on Jordan in recent days, targeting multiple military facilities U.S. forces use in the country. And in Kuwait, officials say Iran struck a power facility in a water desalination plant on Sunday. Carrie Khan, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Ukraine says Russia launched one of its largest ballistic missile attacks of the war today, targeting Kyiv. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports the assault followed Ukrainian drone strikes on Russian tankers and power substations.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Russia launched more than 40 missiles and 120 attack drones at Kyiv. Ukrainians were awoken by the sound of explosions and the booms of air defense trying to shoot down the drones and missiles. Ukraine has developed ways to shoot down most drones, but not missiles, and the military intercepted less than half of the missiles in this attack. Kyiv Mayor Vitaly Klitschko said at least one person was killed and at least 15 injured. Moscow has stepped up attacks on Ukrainian cities as Ukraine continues a drone strike campaign aimed at weakening Russia's war machine. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
In men's soccer, the World Cup final will be held this afternoon at MetLife Stadium in East Rutherford, New Jersey, between Argentina and Spain. NPR's Jasmine Garz has been covering the tournament and expects a good game. She says, while Argentina is the defending champion and has international superstar Lionel Messi, the challenger, Spain, has also played well.
They have given up just one goal in this entire tournament in seven games, which is remarkable. And if they win and don't give another goal up during today's game, that's going to be a record for a winner. But something has to give, right? I mean, so basically what this is Argentina, an offensive powerhouse, and Spain, a defensive powerhouse, who have also proven they can score.
NPR's Jasmine Garst. This is NPR News. An earthquake struck the Andes region of Peru last night. The U.S. Geological Survey put its magnitude at 5.5. Local officials told the Associated Press at least five people were killed and hundreds more displaced. Social media influencers Andrew and Tristan Tate have been arrested by U.S. Marshals in Miami. They're facing rape and sex trafficking charges. NPR's Lauren Frere reports British prosecutors are seeking their extradition.
The United Kingdom's Crown Prosecution Service says Andrew Tate faces seven further counts of rape, three counts related to trafficking, three of assault, and 19 for pornography. Tristan Tate faces an additional count of sexual assault, two of rape, and three related to trafficking. This is in connection with offenses to four additional victims between 2010 and 2017. The Tate brothers are kickboxers turned turned social media stars and are dual British-American citizens. They already face 21 previous charges and have denied any wrongdoing. British prosecutors confirm the Tates have been arrested by US marshals and await extradition to the UK. Lauren Fryer, NPR News, London.
A Cuban dissident and artist arrived in Miami yesterday after serving 5 years in prison. Luis Manuel Otero Gancaro was granted parole into the U.S. as long as he left his country. He shared a Grammy for his song Fatherland and Life that became an anthem for the political opposition in Cuba. His arrest and incarceration has been denounced by human rights organizations and the U.S. government. I'm Noora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Vanguard. With Vanguard Investor Choice, investors can have a voice in how their eligible Vanguard funds vote on key shareholder matters. Learn more at vanguard.com/investor choice.
In the book, I mention this line that I've always loved of Marvin Hagler's when he says something like, if when I die you cut open my brain, you're going to find in it a boxing glove, because that's all I am, a boxer. But in the same way, in a Hagler-like way, I feel even at this advanced age, I still feel I'm that sort of grammar school boy, because it was the crucible in which I became the person that I am.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Hello. Few writers dance across genres with as much wit, irreverence, and intellectual curiosity as Jeff Dyer. From the inventive Out of Sheer Rage about his struggles to write a book on D.H. Lawrence to the award-winning Jazz Meditations of But Beautiful, he's made a career of bending forms to his will. Now, with Homework, his first full-length memoir, Dyer turns that restless mind to his own post-war English childhood and proves even the most straightforward narrative can't escape his signature style. Homework is quintessential Dyer, wry, digressive, and unexpectedly poignant. He reconstructs his working-class childhood, the Airfix models, the hand-me-down football kits, his parents' quiet sacrifices, with a novelist's eye and a stand-up's timing. The laughs come easily, but so does the deeper resonance. This is a story about how class shapes us and how we carry or shed the homes that made us. We also explore some of Dyer's influences, including Ernie Pyle's Brave Men, the stark Second World War dispatches that imprinted themselves on his millions of readers, and Ada Collins' poem, The News, with its knack for finding unease in the ordinary. Jeff, welcome to the show. I'm delighted to have you here.
Thank you, Aaron. I'm every bit as delighted to be on the show.
Jeff, you've written so many books. I can't quite count them all up, but I think at least 20 on subjects ranging from jazz to the photographer Gary Winogrand. A lot of those books reflect in part your own struggle to write about your subjects. How was that struggle different this time around, writing about your own personal history, the history of your childhood?
Yeah, in one way, it was easier because although when I was writing, say, the history of photography or the jazz book, there were a large number of people better qualified to tackle these subjects than me. But in this case, there's no doubt about it. I really am the world's leading authority on this particular subject matter, namely myself. So to that extent, it was easy. I didn't have to research it at all because I'd lived it. I did just have to verify a few facts because memory cannot always be relied on. And in other regards, I think it's the same thing, whatever you're writing, whether you're writing fiction or memoir or anything else, really. The struggle, if you like, but also the pleasure, is trying to substantiate the world that you're writing about to make it as vividly apparent to the readers as possible.
I loved the sensuality of this memoir. I could taste it, could smell it. It really conjures a time and a place, 1960s Britain, a time when Britain was experiencing a rapid kind of progression in many ways, but people were still without the kind of luxuries we take for granted today. You write about the coal fire, your only source of heat, about the outdoor lavatory. You really kind of capture a kind of discomfort that seems to shape perhaps a tolerance, maybe even an affection for minor inconvenience later in your life.
Oh, yes. Although we think of the 60s as being, you know, the swinging 60s, that was a very localized phenomenon. It was London and a few other bits. To a very great degree, large parts of England remained in the 1950s, well into the 1960s. And I think you could even say that it goes further back than that, because the Second World War, in various ways, was so apparent throughout my childhood, most obviously in the realm of play and fun, in the way the Second World War was recreated in comics, films, TV shows, this kind of stuff. Our particular version of the Second World War had nothing to do with Stalingrad or the Holocaust. It was more like an adventure, which we were quite well informed about. But yeah, it was if you think, you know, rationing went on in Britain into the 1950s. And for people of my parents' generation who grew up in a time of real economic hardship in the 1930s, there was an expectation and a readiness to do without things. And I think what happened is that in the 1960s, that entrenched attitude of my parents was starting to become not exactly obsolete, but there was a friction between that and the developing culture of consumer abundance as it was happening. In many ways, far from me accepting things that my parents did, I've become someone who's often railing against their circumstances. So my parents, for example, were always urging patience. And now when I'm sitting on a plane, say, and the flight attendants thank us for our patience because of the delay, I'm always kind of yelling in my head, "You can't thank me for that which I don't have," because I think partly as a consequence of my parents' infinite patience, I've become a raging inferno of impatience. And one of the things that I most dislike about England, and always have done ever since I became fully conscious, is this Soviet-like resignation to things not working, to trains not being on time, all of that sort of stuff. So in some ways, I'm a product of my background, but in other ways, I'm a product of it in terms of an intense reaction against it.
It's interesting you say that. I left the UK 27 years ago, and one of the observations every time I return is that actually there is, I feel, a culture of complaint. If the trains do run on time, people will still find a way to complain about something.
Yes,
maybe, yeah. You know, the tea was cold. I think compared to your parents' generation, perhaps subsequent generations have learned to complain a bit more and maybe accept a little less.
Oh, quite right. Yes, exactly. And corporations have really got the hang of this. They will offer apologies. We sincerely apologize, but they'll do that as a substitute for improvement or compensating. I don't think I ever sent back an item of food in a restaurant before I was in America. It was sort of unheard of, kind of rude in Britain. You were just grateful that this slop was brought to you at all.
Talking about slop, you do have a very a very sharp memory for bad food. I think you say at one point that other than strawberries and tomatoes, you can't remember a single pleasant meal in your entire childhood. Why was 1960s British cuisine so unredeemable? And do you think we've lost something, maybe even community, in the rush towards good taste?
Well, why was it bad? I mean, it just because it had been for quite a long while. And the particular sources of displeasure in the food, I'm talking particularly about the food at my junior school, where my mum worked as a dinner lady, you know, one of the people who was serving this slop. So she was not responsible for it. She wasn't cooking it, but she was certainly serving it up. So that was horrible. And the reason it was horrible is, of course, quite simple, I think, is because it was there for free for us. And it had to be done, you know, within a particular budget. But also there was no particular sort of standard to appeal to. And the important thing is that it was there for free. But then it was every bit as awful at my grammar school. And then in a weird way, even though there were, when I went to Oxford, many colleges were famous for the quality of the food there, it was awful at my college too. So, yeah, bad food was consistent throughout my childhood. And it really wasn't. Honestly, it wasn't till I was about 17 and I made friends with a slightly older couple. They were kind of hippies, really. And for the first time, I discovered food I liked, sort of curries and vegetarian food. What I must say now is, you know, you still get this obsolete idea from the French that the food in England is terrible. The food in England is fantastic now. It's an entirely obsolete complaint now to lament the quality of the food in England.
You write very affectionately of your pleasure in Vesta curries. I had the same pleasure. Tell the listener a little, perhaps, about what a Vesta curry was.
That's the other thing I should have said. As well as this food being made on the cheap in the school canteen, it was also the era of convenience foods. And that took many forms. In the case of the Vesta curry, you'd get a packet of rice, and then you'd get this dried kind of thing, and then you would hydrate it. I think you added water and this sort of curry would emerge. It bore, I suspect, very little relation to any kind of curry you might get in India, especially with beef in it. But it at least had some kind of quality of being different, of being slightly exotic. And it was always pictured on the carton with the rice around it and then this oasis of curry in the middle. Of course, from the 70s onwards, the main sort of form of restaurant in any English town became a kind of Indian restaurant. And I've always enjoyed continuing to eat my curries in that same Vesta style well into my 60s, that is to say, with this surrounding of rice and the curry in the middle. It's a kind of homage to the Vesta years.
My guest, Jeff Dyer, talking about small pleasures there. This is Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. We're talking about Homework, a new memoir by the writer Jeff Dyer. Jeff, you connect your childhood fascination with King Arthur to kind of deeper, maybe mythic terrain. I wonder what that story gave you as a boy and whether it still holds meaning now.
Yeah, it was such a powerful part of my childhood and it resonates to this day. So last week, a Belgian journalist came from Antwerp to interview me here in London. And rather wonderfully, her name was Guinevere. So she came straight out of those sort of Arthurian legends. And there she was sitting in my study. The Arthurian myths were made real. But I think that several things about that. It was so believable and local. So, of course, we're familiar with the Greek myths and there's all the myths of Hinduism. But this was local, homegrown. And also, this is really important, thoroughly believable. It seemed like realism. So if you think of this sword which the young Arthur has to pull from an anvil, and then a hand reaches up from the lake to sort of take the sword back. Well, we used to go on these drives on occasional nights in the summer, and we'd drive back in the deep twilight past this reservoir, this flat reservoir, and it was really possible to imagine out of that darkness the hand appearing with this sword of Arthur Excalibur. It just felt like it was part of the landscape, part of the actual landscape, and crucially, part of every child's mental landscape.
Mm. Jeff, I grew up not too far from you in a small market town or just outside called Marlborough. And it has a burial mound behind the college, a famous sort of public school, not one that I attended, I hasten to add.
Thank you for clarifying that.
I was in the comprehensive just down the road. But I only realized recently that the name Marlborough apparently comes from burial site of Merlin the Wise.
Does it? Yeah. And how interesting you mention Merlin like that, because, yeah, Arthur was there in my childhood. And then, of course, as I get to be an adolescent, start liking prog rock. Well, you know, the Arthurian legends and the Arthurian fashions had a kind of a renaissance in the late 60s and 70s in that sort of hippie era of prog rock. And, of course, it culminates in a way with Rick Wakeman doing his version of the Arthurian legends and that's the point at which progressive rock has gone from being progressive to regressive. It's funny though, Aaron, when you started talking about Marlborough and then you mentioned the public school, this is so interesting about England. Just at that point, I mean, here we are, we're having this lovely, lovely chat, but I just felt that instant kind of thing of antagonism when I thought, oh, he went to that public school, by which, of course, for the benefit of American listeners who think we're being really offensive, by public school, we, of course, mean private schools. And it was how interesting that you felt it was so necessary to explain that you didn't go to a public school. In America, nobody would ever feel the need to make that clear.
Right. We all felt our place in the world. We were sort of made to feel that. You talk in homework, I think, really profoundly about the 11 plus exam.
Oh, yeah.
As the most momentous event in your life, yet also as a kind of educational apartheid. And I wonder how you live with both of those truths at once.
Sure, yes. Well, for people who were at normal state schools, this moment would come at the age of 11 when you'd sit this exam, a series of IQ tests, and it would determine whether you went to one of three kinds of schools, a secondary modern school, a technical school, or if you were in the top sort of tier, you'd go to a grammar school. I passed. I was lucky enough to pass because I think it's now become apparent that this wasn't a completely reliable way of ascertaining a child's intellect. Bear in mind also at the age of 11. Now, the thing is, this really defined to a great extent what your life was going to be like at the age of 11. And in typical way, you think that the idea of this is to allow clever, by which I really mean kids who pass the exam, to go on to a grammar school and get a really good academic education. And once you're at a grammar school, especially if you're at a fantastic grammar school, such as I was, from there at the age of 11, there's a pretty clear path on to A-levels and university. And in the case of my grammar school, there was a strong tradition of people going to Oxford or Cambridge. So that's wonderful, isn't it? You know, should be applauded. It's social mobility, all this kind of stuff. But the truth is, the real purpose of the 11 plus was to ensure that there would be a steady flow of people to work in factories, to get apprenticeships in trades, this kind of stuff. In other words, it was designed really to ensure that people would fail. So there was a workforce, and letting a number of kids past the 11 plus go to a grammar school was the flip side of it. It was the icing, whereas the cake itself was a rather stodgier affair. And of course, it's really awful if at the age of 11, the parameters of your possibilities in your life are defined well before you've fully emerged as as any kind of potential person. Mine was one of the last generations really to take that exam, because it was considered much fairer if everyone went to the same kind of school after that at the age of 11. But I'm absolutely incapable of not feeling a deep sense of gratitude and good fortune for being a beneficiary of that particular system, because it meant that my life was transformed.
Mm. Can you imagine being the person you are today, the writer you are today, without having been, as you say, a grammar school boy.
No, it's. In the book, I mention this line that I've always loved of Marvin Hagler's when he says something like, if when I die you cut open my brain, you're going to find in it a boxing glove, because that's all I am, a boxer. Quite interesting from Marvin Hagler, who's actually went on to have a sort of much richer inner life than is the case with many former boxers. But in the same way, in a Hagler-like way, I feel even at this advanced age, I still feel I'm that sort of grammar school boy, because it was the crucible in which I became the person that I am.
Mm. We were talking earlier about prog rock. Your family, of course, took thrift to a kind of moral level.
Yeah.
Except for one thing, which was a mono record player in a blue leatherette case. Why do you think music, unlike other luxuries, was allowed in? Not very much, as it happens, but a little.
I need to do full justice to my dad's parsimony. So yeah, he didn't mind buying us this record player. It wasn't a major expense. But then he realized that actually it wasn't just a record player, because, of course, the record player needed records. And each week, new records would be released. And he started to realize, my God, this is a potentially endless source of expenditure. It wasn't the case that, like the Taliban, he kind of banned music. But what he did is he underfunded it to the extent that music sort of withered away for quite a while, until my hunger for it became irresistible round about the age of 12 or 13 at grammar school. And by then I had no need for a crappy mono record player. I wanted a little stereo. Little hi-fi of my own, which I duly got.
Mm. It's quite striking how in Homework, your memoir of your life until you go to university, you really vividly illuminate this kind of paradox of being a cultured teenager, interested in music, interested in books, interested in film, who yet has parents who aren't really interested or invested in any of those things.
Yeah, that's the main theme of the second half of the book. So at the grammar school, I start doing well. But more importantly than that, you know, and this is a well-documented story from other people, under the influence of one particular teacher, my English teacher, I started to really love reading and literature. So this whole other realm of life opened up. And as a result of that, I was getting better and better marks and all this kind of stuff. And so, you know, I suppose there's several things going on. So I was reading a great deal. And although if you'd met me at the age of 16, you might have thought, oh, he's just this sort of beer-swilling oik. You know, the truth was, although I had no social skills at all, except for buying beer in a pub when I was too young to do so. Of course, everyone was well versed in that particular social skill by the time they were 16. The truth is, in my head, I had become a kind of much more understanding person because of the books I was reading, because I was starting to read Jane Austen and all that kind of thing. So although God knows I had no ability to talk to girls, I had a great desire to do so. I did know something about them, certainly by the time I was 18, because by then I'd read Middlemarch. So I think that's one of the tensions between the external circumstances that I found myself in and this inner life, this cognitive life, which was well ahead of my social evolution as a person, let's say.
Mm. Jeff, there's a footnote that feels like the heart of the book to me, and it reads, places remain long after they've gone. Do you think that is as the job of the writer to some extent, to keep those places open even after the doors have closed?
Yeah, and it goes right back to Wordsworth in The Prelude, doesn't it, when he says, I would enshrine the spirit of the past for future restoration. Now, whether or not that future restoration occurs is difficult to say, but what gave rise to that particular footnote, I think this is worth explaining, is there were various cinemas in Cheltenham, and it always irritated me the way that my parents would always refer to the ABC or the Odeon or whatever it was. They would refer to it by the name that it had before I was born, the Gaumont or something like that. So for them, that's what it was. And then, of course, needless to say, I myself fell prey to the same thing after the ABC cinema had closed. Still, for me, it's the ABC, even though the cinema is actually no longer there.
Mm. You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. My guest is the prolific author, Jeff Dyer. We're talking about his new memoir, Homework. Jeff, you write at one point, the purpose of life is to keep boredom at bay. Has that pursuit of not being bored been a kind of artistic compass for you?
Yes. And one of the ways in which I've avoided being bored is by writing all these different books on a great array of subjects. And we talked about the education that I'd had. And of course, in a way, the typical sort of direction of education in England is to greater and greater specialism. So I did, I don't know, however many O levels, then I did 3 A levels, and then I did English at university. And at that point, I'd had enough. I jumped ship because I had no desire to embark on the still further specialization of a PhD. And I think by that time, I'm about 21, 22 when I graduate, I started to realize that there were all sorts of other things beyond literature that I was becoming curious about: cinema, music, jazz, all of this kind of stuff. So I think what's happened is that I've remained a perpetual student in a way, and writing all of these different kind of books has been a way of continuing this self-funded, self-propelled education.
Let's stay with jazz. You mentioned that you've tackled that. It's a very successful book. I think it won the Somerset Maugham Award, but Beautiful, it's called. It's essentially an appreciation of jazz maestros from Duke Ellington and Lester Young to Chet Baker and Art Pepper. In that book, you really bring to life their stories, but also the sort of downward trajectories of many of them as drugs, racism, alcoholism, mental illness, and violence take their toll. I wonder what those stories told you or taught you about America before moving here.
Yeah, well, let's put it like this. Jazz really was a specifically American art form. And I had to go to America to write that book, of course, because I really needed to be just sort of immersed in the world that jazz grew out of. And it wasn't entirely surprising to me the world I encountered in America, because of course everyone is exposed to America very, very early with the Westerns and all that kind of thing. But I think the main thing for me, as somebody who'd had a literary education, to make a rather unfair comparison, let's suppose you really love the work of E.M. Forster, but God, E.M. Forster's life, it's really not very interesting. Whereas these jazz musicians, for all sorts of reasons, because of being on the road, because of racism, because of the weird sort of ambivalence of their status, these were incident-packed lives. And also you can feel the history of the times in their music. They had this sort of mythic quality about them, which I found endlessly fascinating. And there'd be these sort of stories of Chet Baker getting his teeth knocked out. That certainly didn't happen to E.M. Forster, getting his teeth knocked out by a drug addict. But what was especially interesting about jazz musicians is that although they were, hugely important figures, they were still accessible in a way, let's say, that Madonna wouldn't be. So there'd be all this kind of wealth of recollection from quite ordinary people who happened to have come across, I don't know, Ben Webster, say, or something like that. And I love this intersection of these mythic, almost godlike figures with really quite ordinary people. So I love the way that, for example, Ben Webster, when he's living in Copenhagen, he became great friends with the janitor of his block of flats where he was living. They couldn't speak each other's language, but they were united by their shared love of that great thing, beer.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and I'm talking with Jeff Dyer about his new memoir, Homework, as well as his book choice, Brave Men, a collection of wartime dispatches by legendary foreign correspondent Ernie Pyle. We'll be back after this.
Hey everyone, it's Tom Kandel from CurtCall. This week on the show, I'm taking you inside one of the most influential organizations in American theater. It's New Dramatists. Join me for a fascinating conversation with artistic director Emily Morse, playwright and Broadway librettist Christopher Diaz, and Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Susan Laurie Parks as we explore mentorship and the creative process behind some of today's most celebrated theater. That's this week on Curtain Call, Monday night at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
Boy gets girl, boy loses girl, boy freaks out after he sees girl with some other boy on Instagram a week after they broke up. I'm Meg Wolitzer, and on the next Selected Shorts, fiction about stuffing our messy lives into the perfect frame. Don't miss it.
Selected Shorts, Sunday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and I'm talking with Jeff Dyer about his new memoir, Homework, as well as his book choice, Brave Men, a collection of wartime dispatches by Ernie Pyle. Jeff, you have chosen as your book today Ernie Pyle's classic war reporting collection, Brave Men. Pyle, the sort of soft-spoken Hoosier who became America's most beloved World War II correspondent, didn't analyze strategy from afar. He lived alongside the GIs on the front lines from North Africa to Okinawa. His writing conveys a deep compassion, honoring, I guess, the everyday soldier. It's an extraordinary collection of vignettes, of columns. I was struck by the fact that Ernie Pyle had 12 million readers in his day. He was published in 200 newspapers and 400 weeklies, which makes me extremely nostalgic for a time when journalism really counted, really mattered.
Lord, yes.
but maybe start by telling me why you chose this book to read today.
Yeah, partly because I've read it only recently. So what I'll do is I'll explain how I came to read it. I always liked reading military history, and then I was conscious that when I was reading so many different accounts of various episodes from the war in Europe, they'd always quote from this person, Ernie Pyle. Several things. First of all, what an unfortunate name, really. You feel, you know, his name would have endured much more if he'd been called, I don't know, Rock Hudson or something like that. So it's, it's a very unfortunate sounding name. But whenever these people quoted passages from Ernie Pyle, I was always struck by the way, by how good they were. And this really came to a head when I was reading Rick Atkinson's, you know, amazing history of the Sicilian and Italian campaign. And he quotes an awful lot of Ernie Pyle in that book. And it was, these passages were so good that I couldn't bear to just have them presented in quotation marks anymore. I wanted to read the real thing. So I got a copy of Brave Men. It's a great edition, this American edition, because it does that important thing. It makes you realize that, oh, this is not something from history. Well, of course it is. I mean, it's presented in a very contemporary way. So what it means that you get is this, these reports. I mean, he was under a lot of pressure as a reporter. So in the midst of situations of really extreme personal danger, he was banging this stuff out, fulfilling the daily obligations as a reporter. But it also, of course, couldn't be more place and time specific, but of course it also has the timeless quality, which takes us right back to Ezra Pound's famous definition of literature. Literature is news that stays news. So yeah, Ernie Pyle, that's what he's writing, news that stays news.
He may have had an unfortunate name, and it might not ring in the quite the same way as Rock Hudson, but he did become immortalized in a Hollywood movie, the story of G.I. Joe,
yeah,
which is his story, a 1945 American war film, the year he died, killed while reporting from the Pacific. And that starred Robert Mitchum and Burgess Meredith, who played Pyle. I haven't seen that movie. Have you?
I haven't actually, but I'm very, very curious to do so. But actually, it's also not an accident that I haven't seen it, because I'm still enjoying the sort of imprint of idea of Ernie Pyle that I have, this rather sort of prematurely aged looking person. It's not surprising that he looked older than his years, because one of the reasons he was so loved is, well, partly because of the quality of his writing, but also because he really did share not just the danger, but the discomfort of the people he was writing about. I should add, he wrote about every aspect. He spent time with, you know, all sorts of different people involved in the war effort, but the special place in his heart was always for the infantryman, the sort of grunt, as it were. And I mean, one of the things that he stresses is that, yes, you know, when we see war films, we're all very familiar with, and now thanks to the technology, really since Saving Private Ryan onwards, we can sort of share the danger. But what he brings out so well again and again is these other things. One, being hungry, being filthy, dirty, and the endless, unrelieved exhaustion of what the soldiers were doing. And, you know, Pyle himself became exhausted and at one point, you know, decided, that's it, I can't do this anymore, but felt a real obligation once the war in Europe had been won. I felt a great moral obligation to his readers and also, I think, to the other troops who were going to report on the Pacific War, even though he was worn out and even though I think he felt he was living on borrowed time. I mean, he felt he had to do that and, of course, tragically was killed by a sniper.
As you say, he really reported from the front line, from the mud, not from the map. He really absorbed the experience of the ordinary GI. I wonder what lessons you think Pyle's writing offers about the ethics of witnessing and of proximity. Could a voice like his still cut through today, do you think?
Yes, I think it could. And actually, one of the interesting things, if you think of that movement of the new journalism and the kind of principles as sort of advocated by Tom Wolfe, of full immersion in the experiences that you're reporting about, of enabling the reader to see through the eyes of the people you're writing about. You know, really, it turns out that, oh, there was nothing so very new after all about the new journalism, because Ernie Pyle was the new journalist before the term was invented. And it's really, really striking how many scenes, how many episodes in a book like Michael Hare's Dispatches from the Vietnam War, they're very, very similar to scenes that Ernie Pyle writes about. And I guess that's one of the other things, that although the technology has changed enormously, in many ways, the discomforts and agonies of the frontline soldier really remain the same. And I marked quite a lot of passages when he's describing, for example, the colossal destruction that he witnesses, the sheer waste of war. Well, we see that daily now from Ukraine and Gaza. I guess there's one other thing when you're talking about the ethics of war. One of the reasons Pyle was so popular is because he made these ordinary men, these brave men, into heroes. And I think perhaps a slight weakness of the book is his insistence on the decency and kindness of American troops. But then, of course, you read in Rick Atkinson's book about the Italian campaign, this sort of extraordinary sort of episode of execution of prisoners, which was hushed up at the time and only became apparent later. Yeah, he rather overdoes the what he calls the typical American tender-heartedness.
I think George Orwell had mixed opinions about Ernie Pyle. He felt maybe he could be too sentimental on occasion. Of course, Orwell could be sentimental himself.
Yes, indeed. Orwell was sentimental about the English, of course. Yeah, so yeah, that's a very good comparison, I think, Pyle and Orwell. But I think another comparison that enables Pyle to come out very well is there's nothing swaggering or macho or self-advertising about him, the way that there was about another correspondent who entered Paris, you know, for the liberation about the same time as him, namely Ernest Hemingway. And I think that's quite a good comparison because Pyle shares Hemingway's ability, this is Hemingway at his best, to bring out powerful emotions, not by any kind of soaring music in the prose, but by a very, very close attention to the details of what is seen and what is happening.
There's a quote that speaks to that I wrote down, where he writes, "A soldier came and sat beside me while I was eating. He lit a cigarette, cupping his hands around it like a man in a high wind. Though there was no wind, his hands were shaking." It's just such a small, wonderful detail. It reveals trauma in a simple gesture.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and he does that. He does that again and again, week after week. I mean, so yeah, I think not only is he exhausted from just the sort of roughing it, but to maintain that level of perceptual awareness is itself quite exhausting, I think.
He's quite famous for one column in particular, the death of Captain Wasco. Its power lies again in a way, and what's not said, in silence and gesture. Do you see that column as a kind of template for how we might write elegy today?
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, it's not for nothing that it's deservedly famous, let's say. It's incredibly moving as he describes the death of this much-loved captain. And then he just describes a couple of soldiers coming up and sort of paying their respects. And all he does is just observe people in this very profound moment of loss. And the fact that it's understated and just observational really lends it an extra power. And the key thing is that although it's about Captain Henry Wasco, it could be about almost anyone. And then crucially, it has to come to an end, this episode. But of course, for the soldiers he's describing who are paying their respects, they can't linger there too long. They get on and go on to the next thing, because although that particular battle's at an end, you know, there is still the rest of Europe to be trudged through.
I wonder, Jeff, how this book changes perhaps our understanding of the line between journalism and literary nonfiction, if it's even useful to draw that distinction, or is the achievement of Ernie Pyle here precisely in the way he collapses those categories?
Yeah, I mean, this was something that interested me very much, because during the invasion of Afghanistan, there was a certain amount of talk about, you know, when will the great novel emerge from this? And I, for one, was in no hurry at all for the great novel to emerge from it, because, and I think here Pyle had set an important precedent, although we weren't getting the great novel emerging, we were getting great literature emerging in the form of reportage. And there's so many great books that came out of that. And I'll name just two. You know, there's The Forever War by Dexter Filkins, and then the book by David Finkel, The Good Soldier. And these were great literary achievements. But what were they? Well, they were books of reporting. And in particular, David Finkel described his method as being as follows. He said, each sentence reports a fact, and the next sentence reports another fact. And out of that, a kind of narrative emerges. And there I feel, well, that's pretty close to the Ernie Pyle method.
He's also not at all self-aggrandizing. He doesn't really he doesn't center himself in the narrative at all. He's present, but never foregrounded, right?
Yeah. And he talks about, you know, how he's managed to fall sick in basically every theater of war that he's been reporting about. Yeah, so he's always putting himself in the service of the people he's writing about. I should add that, of course, I mean, you were talking about how many people were reading him. He was very, very famous and much loved, not just by his readers back in America, but of course by the people he was writing about and spending time with. I mean, he was a real celebrity, actually, but it's difficult to imagine a more modest celebrity, let's say.
I'd love to tie this back to homework. And I think one way that I've found that perhaps does that, apart from the omnipresence of the Second World War in the era in which you grew up, is the way that Pyle writes about loss. I mean, he does so, I think, despite that criticism from Orwell, generally without sentimentality. And in your own work, in homework, I think you've found ways of writing about loss that also feel comparably honest, unsentimental. Would that be a way you might characterize your own writing?
The book, the main body of the book, ends at the age of 18 when I get a place at Oxford. But then there's a pretty lengthy sort of afterward, which is really focused on my mum and dad dying. They both died in the same year. What was the worst thing about my mother's dying? Well, it actually wasn't her dying. It was mainly her not being able to die. It was a long, drawn-out, awful process, and she wanted to die at home, and of course, many people do. But that creates all sorts of difficulties, because in many ways, hospitals are better able to cope with the slow deterioration of a body. So I felt it was necessary to mention a lot of the details of her gradually succumbing like that, and also to be frank about the way that there was, because of this process I'd been through, there was a certain distance between me and my parents, and how this experience of their dying was in a way, it would be really sentimental to say that, and then, you know, all these differences went away. There was an element of that, but still, you know, there was no denying the things that had gone on that had led us to having very, very different lives.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with the author and critic, Jeff Dyer. We're talking about some of his favorite work. Jeff, let's talk briefly about Ada Collins. You have selected a poem called The News from a collection, It Is Daylight. Yeah. I'm not familiar with Ada Collins any more than I was with Ernie Pyle, so you've brought me two real delights.
Yeah.
I wonder if we could talk about why this is such a great poem, the sort of alchemy that it performs, and perhaps maybe start with a reading of the poem and then how you came across it.
Yeah, I hope if Ada gets to hear this, I hope she'll forgive my reading it. I mean, for reasons that will become apparent, it's sort of inappropriate for a man to be reading it. But anyway, a poem called The News, and this is my, depending on how you feel about it, this is my rendering or my butchering of it. The News. At last, terror has arrived. Next door, the house has gone up in flames. A woman runs from the burning wreck, her face smeared with blood and ashes. She screams that her children are kidnapped. It's truly exciting, and what more would anyone ask? For a rare and beautiful egg to present itself in the grass? For sex with the liquor store owner to progress into something meaningful? You don't know what I've done in front of the mirror. I've pulled my shorts up high like a thong. I've walked back and forth, doing little kicks and making faces. I've stopped. I've stared. I try to get my mind around the sight of myself. I make a face of great seriousness. I imagine that I had just received a large and upsetting piece of news. Then I look into my eyes. Can I guess what I am thinking? Can I tell you what it is?
I love that poem so much.
So do I. I love it, and I don't really understand what it's about.
Maybe we don't have to. It's a poem. It maybe speaks to us on kind of levels that we can't always articulate. But for me, the staring at herself in the mirror is such a confession that I think rings true probably for all of us.
Yeah. And so what I'll do actually, Aaron, I'll just explain the circumstances in which I came across this poem. And I should say, I love this whole book. So I was teaching in Iowa, I guess, in about 2013, 2012, something like this. Anyway, there was this double bill featuring Charles Baxter, a prose writer who I know a bit and whose work I really love. So I was going to it for that. And then as the support band, as it were, it was this young woman, Ada Collins. And she started reading. And just from right from the start, I just loved these poems. They just had such a sort of hold on me. And I loved the stories that unfolded, even though they were never stories in a traditional kind of narrative way. They weren't narrative poems. There was something about the tone of them, the tone which was so exactly synonymous with some kind of mysterious state of mind of somebody being often in very, very familiar circumstances, but somehow sort of stranded in the midst of this familiarity, almost like somebody in some sort of weird fugue state. And I found them absolutely transfixing. And they were also, and this is a quality which I particularly love. I mean, I really want to make it clear to the listeners, I don't only love poets whose last name is Collins, but Ada Collins shares with the great Billy Collins this quality, that these poems are very, very funny as well, I think.
There's certainly wit there, but also it kind of blurs the boundaries between public catastrophe and private disintegration.
Yeah, doesn't it? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And often there's this sort of stunned sense of some kind of trauma or something that's gone on. And often there's this kind of elision of the person and the rooms in which they find themselves. I mean, you know, that title, It Is Daylight. I found myself thinking quite a few occasions of those strange, empty rooms that you get in some of Edward Hopper's later paintings. Mm. You know, it's daylight there, it's all very clear, but you're always feeling this, even though nothing is blurry or hidden, some sort of mystery is going on here. And what I think what keeps me so perennially engaged with these poems is that there's some sort of mystery in them, which I can't get to the heart of. Something has happened which even the most skilled detective can't quite solve. I guess the other thing to emphasize, although the tone is very freewheeling, they're very, very wild poems, but they're also very taut and disciplined as well. So I think what enables her to do that, well, it's this wonderful flexibility of tone.
Mm. At the same time, that flexible tone can be quite affectless. And I wonder what that does for the poem.
Yeah, it just gives them this strange sort of quality of being kind of self-bewildering, really. And you get the sense that the speaker is just trying to make sense of what's going on. And quite often the scene is a kind of an ordinary suburban street, but it's rendered with a kind of visionary exactness. She's very much a sort of poet of the kind of the everyday visionary, but there's something sort of lurking there in broad daylight, if you like. I think also they're very, very private poems in a way. People are walking around in this world, in this, in this revealed, but nonetheless completely hidden kind of way. Yeah, I find them just endlessly, endlessly fascinating. And I say that genuinely because I've now had this book of poems for more than 10 years.
Jeff, this has been such a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about Homework and two of your favorite works, Brave Men by Ernie Pyle and Ada Collins' poem, The News.
Great. Thank you very much, Aaron. It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking about Brave Men by Ernie Pyle, published by Penguin Classics, and the poem, The News, by Ada Collins, from her first collection, It Is Daylight, published by Yale University Press. Jeff Dyer's memoir, Homework, is published by Farrar, Strauss and Giroux. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood.
Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and 1 Gram Books in collaboration with Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify with guests such as Alan Cumming, John Waters, Jeanette Winterson, and Ada Calhoun. While you're there, why not give us a 5-star review? It helps others find the show.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Never Sink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeverSinkGeneralStore.com, and from listeners like you.
Why are so many people caught in doom loops of sad or anxious thoughts? New research suggests it might be because their mental maps have stopped updating.
So you have this kind of recipe for, you know, turning on the sadness machine and then locking all the doors for other visitors that might interrupt sadness.
Fixing our mental maps, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Monday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Ronald Kelson. Thank you for helping end our summer fun drive. The support from listeners like you was phenomenal. This station only exists because you continue to stand with us. Thank you for your support.